too obvious? I'm sorry.
Felix.
What do you mean?
It's either that or Weird Science by Oingo Boingo. And, you know, Danny Elfman's had problems lately, so I went with Thomas Dolby.
Yeah, okay. Well, thank you. Everybody needs to just cheer on science once in a while. Early last year, the Pacific Science Center shocked local preservationists when they floated a plan to fill in the reflecting pools of the historic courtyard at Seattle's center by planting native plants and putting them in soil. Those plans got put on hold for some additional public process, which we're very good at. And our resident historian Felix Bunnell is here with the update on that.
Yeah, why don't we have a public process center somewhere? That Absolutely. Would be fitting for Seattle.
Every day is public process.
And everybody loves Pacific Science Center. It's housed in what was built for the 1962 Seattle World's Fair as the United States Science Pavilion. Series of box-like buildings surrounding an elegant courtyard with platforms and stairs, those distinctive arches, and shallow pools of water that reflect the light. Now, it was all designed by Seattle-born Japanese-American architect Minoru Yamasaki in a style that came to be called Space Age Gothic. And you can see elements in the Science Pavilion design that Yamasaki would carry forward to his most famous work, the late great World Trade Center in Manhattan. And the Seattle building is on the Landmark Register, of course. Now, a year ago, Science Center staff gave a presentation to the Landmarks Preservation Board. They said those shallow pools are leaking many, many gallons of water and need millions of dollars of work to repair. One option they were considering was to do away with the water in the south pool completely. That's the pool furthest from the entrance on the Seattle Center grounds. And fill it in with soil to create a meadow for native plants. Now, there's a lot of pushback and public outcry over the proposal. We covered it on this show a couple times. The Science Center took a step back and launched a larger community engagement process to reach not just grumpy historic preservationists, but also connect with audiences and communities not currently being served or currently being underserved by the Science Center in terms of their programs and facilities. Now, leading the effort is Machen Petri. She's the Vice President of Finance and Operations for the Science Center. There have been a lot of meetings and surveys and focus groups to find out what current barriers are in the way of those underserved groups. Now, when I spoke with her a few days ago, I asked Machen Petri what the people they talked to during this process said specifically about the pools.
Well, so we did not directly ask. We were trying as much as possible to have really open-ended questions as we went out to the community. So our questions were things like, what would make you feel more welcome? What would you like to stay in this space? What would you like to change in this space? You know, pretty open-ended, broad questions that we were using.
So I guess I understand the methodology to step back and consider the whole package of the Science Center rather than just one of the iconic physical features. I know when we did a very unscientific Twitter poll a year ago, 70% of the people said keep the pools and restore them and everything. Mm-hmm.
Did you point that out to her?
I don't think I did. See, I think it's sort of everybody knows that. So what did those community members say they wanted? Now, the Science Center is going to release a public summary in the near future, but we're ahead of the curve here, Dave, on the show, as you know, of course. And Machen Petri gave us a preview.
There's a great call for more engaging content in the space from a lot of our focus groups. They like programming and interactivity, which is going to really help us with the programming that we bring into the space. They also want a space that is comfortable and has places to sit and relax and eat. They want this to be like a community space.
Now, so instead of filling it with water, they're going to fill it with content.
And picnic tables. Yeah, so there's no clear direction for the pools at this point, but one really interesting proposal related directly to the courtyard came out of that community engagement process, and it might be acted on sooner rather than later. Now, this is based on the fact that as it currently stands, when it comes to the north side of the Science Center, that's the side that connects directly to the Seattle Center grounds, many people they talked to said the ticket booths and the fencing that had been there for decades are not welcoming or inviting.
There was a really strong call. It came through in the survey as well as with some of the other groups that we spoke to for a removal of the gate so that the courtyard could just be openly accessible. And that's something that we are really seriously considering and may even be considering in the more near term than some of these larger changes that need to happen.
So that would mean relocating the ticket booth someplace else on the site and removing about a 40-foot stretch of fence. It would actually make the courtyard open to the public the way it was during the World's Fair. So this is kind of interesting because you go there now, I was there yesterday. Big tall fence in the way. You have to kind of stick your head through the gate or the iron bars to figure out what's going on. So this would make it more welcoming so the public at any time go into the courtyard. That's pretty radical and sounds pretty cool to me. Now that could happen sometime in the next year, well ahead of the rest of the courtyard project. We'll get to the timing about that in a second. Now they also told me the leaks of that pool got worse last summer on the north side in particular, and so they drained it. when I looked at it yesterday, it looks like the tide just went out. I think it had rained or something, but there's sort of these statues of the dinosaur and the big seagull, and like it's very strange looking.
Are there clamshells? And
I took a picture. I zoomed in. I looked at the picture later. I could see a coin jammed into one of the rocks.
Of course.
When they drained the pool, they decided they had to come up with some kind of temporary option for it. And they hope to announce that by the end of this month and get something in there before the summer. Now, she couldn't be more specific, but I asked Machen Petri for a hint.
I guess as a hint, there's really two kind of main options that we're toggling between. One is some sort of art installation, which I realize is very vague. That could be almost anything, but it would be some sort of collaboration or partnership to develop some sort of art installation in this space. Or we're considering a way to introduce plants in some way in a more temporary fashion.
So it's kind of wedging, getting the door slightly open, getting the plants in, and then they'll be there for the end of time.
How about water lilies?
Well, there's no water. It would be dirt lilies.
Well, you put the water
in,
then you could have both the plants and the water.
I'll mention that to them next time I talk. I suggested Jell-O, blue-colored Jell-O, that it would look like water. It would be safe. Kids could jump up and down on it. Now, I also checked in with Eugenia Wu of Preservation Group Historic Seattle. They were briefed on this process by the Science Center back in December, and they're keeping an open mind as the process unfolds. Historic Seattle, not surprisingly, of course, loves the Yamasaki design. They love seeing the pool and the water in the pools. I told Eugenia Wu that it sounded like Historic Seattle's position hasn't really changed.
That's correct. Our position has been consistent. It's a preservation perspective, and it's not an unreasonable perspective. Not to say that there can't be any changes, but they really need to be sensitive to the original design intent and not be such a drastic change to it.
So there'll be more to come when this public report on the community engagement process gets released by the Science Center. We'll also know more about the temporary use of the North Pool later this month. I do worry that it is kind of a slippery slope. If you get all the temporary plants in there and then let's just leave them.
Exactly.
Who knows? So we'll report on this. I guarantee we'll keep up on this story here. And the overall courtyard project, which they were kind of hot to trot on a year ago, is now on hold till probably 2027, probably a $30 million budget. So lots more process to come, but you could see some picnic tables, some other things, some other surprises there in that North Pool next to the seagull and the dinosaur statue.
Felix Pinnell, all his features are at MyNorthwest.com. Thank you, Felix.
Thanks, Dave.
Let's go to the House of Representatives now. All eyes are on that big decision with lawmakers deliberating whether to pass a bill that would basically ban TikTok in the U.S. And for the details, I called up CBS congressional correspondent Scott McFarlane.
It's going to be a late morning vote. It's going to steamroll the passage. And what it basically says is that TikTok has to separate itself, divest from its China-based owner, ByteDance, or face a ban in U.S. app stores within the next few months. TikTok has said that's not tenable to so quickly find a buyer for something that is now uniquely valuable and uniquely large. But the U.S. House is going to speak with one voice on this today, Dave. And I got to tell you, it was really striking last week. Just 2 days after this bill was introduced, it passed the key House Energy and Commerce Committee 50-0.
Wow.
You couldn't get a bill past that committee that says puppy dogs are cute and ice cream is delicious by a 50-0 margin. It's really striking.
Well, that's encouraging that there's at least some bipartisanship. But my big question is, and of course we have to ask the question, which side is Trump on?
See, he's been on both sides, which is inconvenient for folks trying to forecast what happens next. He was in favor of a TikTok ban during his presidency and shortly after his presidency. But now he's equivocating, saying that you can't get rid of TikTok or it makes Facebook too popular and too big. And of course, he's got concerns about Facebook because after January 6th and the insurrection, Facebook banned him. He certainly has the ability to leverage Republicans to go against anything he wants them to. But he has been a bit ambiguous about the specific contours of this bill. And I think the sponsors of this bill are rushing it to a vote before he clarifies his position anymore and they lose traction.
I've read a couple of articles implying that somebody with investments in TikTok somehow got to Trump and maybe promised some money.
You are referring to Jeffrey Yass,
yes,
who is tied to the Conservative Club for Growth and has been one of the most prodigious donors to Republican campaigns in America, in American history. Yass has not just financial ties to TikTok, but significant financial ties to TikTok. He didn't comment to CBS News' request for comment about his lobbying on this bill or any potential lobbying on this bill. But there's a certain Republican presidential candidate who's in need of money and certainly wants to see donations triggered across the board for his party. So all of this gets messy in that sense. But that's another reason, potentially, these sponsors of this TikTok bill are sprinting toward a vote today to get this thing through before more opposition forms. And I just note this, one of the key people behind this bill is from Washington State. It's Kathy McMorris Rogers, the retiring chair of the House Energy Committee. Her fingerprints are all over this bill, and this is quite a valedictory for her.
CBS congressional correspondent Scott McFarland. Now, in terms of this rich donor, Jeff Yass, and Forbes says he's worth about $28.5 billion. I was curious if there's actually been any money that's changed hands here and whether a donation to the Republican Party would be contingent on burying this bill today.
Well, he has donated millions of dollars to Republicans, including Republican leaders, over the past few years. And that's not a small amount of money, obviously. But those donations don't seem to have had quite the immediate impact that perhaps TikTok supporters would like, because Republican House leadership, which has benefited from Jeffrey Yass's money, has let this thing go to the floor and has signaled their support. So if he's investing to try to save TikTok, it isn't working. So here's what TikTok's doing, Dave. They are supporting and mobilizing TikTok users, their super users, their influencers, their most famous faces, to be at the Capitol this week, trying to lobby against this bill, putting them up for media interviews, trying to get them in front of lawmakers. They're doing that instead of putting their CEO and top brass in front of cameras. Potentially a wise PR strategy, but right now not an effective legislative strategy.
And they've also gone beyond the high-profile influencers.
TikTok tried to mobilize its rank-and-file users with a push alert twice in the past 2 weeks. Call your congressman, tell him to get rid of this bill. And that backfired because it showed the perniciousness, the reach of TikTok, that they can geolocate people, including young people, and get them to mobilize. That's the fear Congress has, that China could manipulate this to mobilize Americans in any way they see fit. So it was a strategy, but one that didn't seem to do well for TikTok.
That's the big vote today in the House on whether TikTok stays or goes. This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. Incivility appears to be an epidemic in America, so let's talk to somebody who has studied it. Jim Link is with the Society for Human Resource Management. They call it SHRM for short. And first of all, how do you go about studying incivility?
Well, you know, it's a very interesting question because we did not know the answer to that not so long ago. So we conducted a long-term research study with our membership, which is about 330,000 global members, to help us really define what civility is. And more importantly, help us to define if what we were hearing anecdotally was actually on the rise in the workplace.
And in fact, you found that it was?
We found exactly that it was. As a matter of fact, when you look at the research, nearly two-thirds of U.S. workers told us that they'd experienced or witnessed incivility in their workplace within the past month.
Wow.
Additionally, yeah, I know. It's just incredible, these numbers with what we found here. Another third of U.S. workers told us that they believe that workplace conflict is going to increase over the next 12 months. And so, as you can imagine, we started to ask why.
Yeah. Well, no wonder so many people want to continue working from home. So when we talk about incivility in the workplace, what form does it typically take? Is it language? Is it or pushing and shoving? What is it?
You know, we asked that question as well, and the members certainly told us what they thought there. It involved things like just the way you address others disrespectfully, interrupting, or even worse, silencing other people when they're speaking. Monitoring and micromanaging showed up on the research results, as did ignoring other people or paying little attention to them. So did unprofessional and disrespectful body language. And we even heard some instances of physical altercations.
Well, but some of that sounds like it's pretty subjective. How do you differentiate between incivility and simple disagreement?
You know, that's a great question. And it's a good question because one of the solution sets we believe that will help solve this problem is dialogue. Mm-hmm. And dialogue, as you know, involves empathetic listening on steroids. And that focus of engaging in that dialogue all along, recognizing that you're not always going to agree on the outcome, is I think, part and parcel of the solution set that we're trying to reintroduce back in workplaces. it's in our minds very much in many ways the lost art of civility. Mm-hmm. And so what we're asking and even giving people the tools and resources to do is to refocus and re-energize that concept of civility as a workplace expectation. Hmm.
So if somebody, say, I don't know, gives you the side eye during a meeting or suddenly crosses their arms and goes harumph, or, you know, uses an obscenity, you say, time out, can we discuss this?
No, I think the way to do that is if there's an expectation in your organization that any of those things that you just described won't occur, then absolutely, mm-hmm. You call that out. To us, it's even more base than that, though. I think managers and leaders, through their mission and vision statements, through their value statements, through their guiding principles in organizations, need to clearly define what's acceptable and not acceptable in their work culture. And if they are good at defining what that is and then hold others accountable to that in the workplace, the outcome is going to be just what you described. If you witness something that goes against those guiding principles of that specific organization's definition of civility, then by all means, you call it out and hold people accountable for it.
Yeah. I'm always curious as to why, when people get rude, why they do it. Presumably, if it's happening in a workplace environment, you behave that way because you don't feel that your message would get across otherwise. Now, my experience is it basically works against your message. But, I mean, if people think it will get results, then they will behave that way. If they learn it doesn't get results, then I would think the behavior would stop.
Yeah, I mean, that's a logical conclusion to draw. That absolutely. What we find is that there's often the problem that expectation of what that behavior is not really well known in an organization. And so if you spend time working on what those expectations are, and more importantly, you role model that as a manager or a leader in the organization, then that expectation is set. So to us, the idea that you spend time crafting that culture to produce a more inclusive environment where the rules of engagement are clearly known and understood, that's clearly part of the solution set.
Yeah, so that's what we're talking about, establishing an office culture that everybody can buy into.
Yeah, and it's just not an office culture, right? In organizations large and small, and no matter the type of work, civility or a lack of civility can certainly be present. And when you think about how people perceive the interactions that they have with peers, with bosses, with subordinates, with even executive leaders in the organization, those things we know create a very unique employee experience. And an employee experience means everything. It means that if you work in a civil environment and what you perceive to be a civil environment, you're more likely to stay there. We know the opposite is also true. We know that more than 60% of people who answered the survey who believed that they worked in an uncivil environment also reported dissatisfaction with their job. And half of those people that were surveyed intended to leave that job. So if you're a business leader and you are a business leader who is in an environment that's perceived by your employees to be uncivil, then the outcome of that is felt on your bottom line. If you have massive amounts of turnover, I mean, that impact, it's cost to hire people and it costs in productivity.
Yeah. A lot of it is getting to know people, right? I mean, I can remember as a kid, anytime I heard an obscenity, I crossed that person off my list. I figured they came from a bad home, that they were, you know, either, you know, dumb or violent or both. And then, you know, come to find that these days, curse words are punctuation marks. And most people don't really mean anything by them. So part of that, I guess, is figuring out ways to know a little bit more about people than just nodding to them in the halls.
That's exactly right. And of course, this time period in which we now find ourselves, particularly after a pandemic, when many of us were forced to work in unusual circumstances, to say the least, probably aided or added to the situation in which we find ourselves today. And let's not forget the role of technology itself. Technology sometimes makes those who would not otherwise engage in any type of civil or uncivil discourse in an organization, they suddenly feel emboldened or brave because they think that there's a piece of technology sitting between them and the recipient of that particular uncivil action. So, yeah, there have been many factors out there that in the last few years that certainly could have contributed to what we're seeing now in the workplace. Here at SHRM, we're just absolutely focused now on trying to bring that element of civility back into the workplace and bring it back as quickly as we can.
Jim Link is with the Society for Human Resource Management. Some good advice, Jim. Thank you.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
Your Daily Dose of Kindness brought to you by Heritage Homecraft. A barber in the Bay Area found a unique way to combat graffiti.
This longtime San Francisco barber has never been the type to ruffle anyone's feathers. But when faced with unsightly graffiti next to his beloved shop, rather than duck responsibility, Shorty Maniachi hatched a plan.
This was just me messing around and having fun, and it turned out to be something great.
His weapon of choice? Rubber duckies. Hundreds of them.
I see a lot of people smile, and I smile every time I look at it.
It all started innocently enough.
Oh, fun, look.
Shorty had some rubber ducks left over from a Halloween party and decided to put them to good use.
Who doesn't love a rubber duck?
Armed with a drill and a vision, he began attaching these funny fowl to the boarded up business next door. The result, a colorful work of art. So colorful, in fact, it became a hotspot for influencers looking for that extra duck-themed dazzle.
I've never seen, like, a wall of ducks before, and I just had to take a selfie.
Ooh, I like that one.
All in all, he's got about 700 rubber duckies of all different shapes and colors. There's a pirate, a unicorn, a clown, and some that aren't ducks at all.
I've had people ask me where they come from, China, and tell them I don't know where they migrated from, but they're safe here now.
When someone occasionally spray paints them, Shorty quickly finds a replacement. The best part, those rubber ducks aren't just good for the neighborhood, they're also good for business.
This was a corner nobody looked at. It's helped, and the ducks have definitely got them to stop looking and go, oh, this place is kind of cool.
Getting out of a hairy situation, now that his barbershop is all the buzz.
So if your plastic ivy doesn't work out, you could just get some duckies.
Cover it up with rubber ducks, whatever works. And now from the Gene Ursula Show, here he is, G. Scott. The employee roster at the Seahawks continues to change.
It does. And usually that's what happens when you have someone come in that is going to be the person is in charge and they have a vision for how they want their team to be. Or, you all know how I like to do it. I like to relate it to everyone that's listening, how you want your systems to be in place. Well, Mike McDonald and John Schneider have a vision for how they want this next team to be. So far, there's been some action as far as some players not coming back to the team. But in free agency so far, there have been, you had Leo Williams. He's going to be coming back. Really big guy. A big cat. He's going to be back for the Seahawks.
How big is the big cat?
I'm looking him up right now.
You know, Colleen be up on it. He's like 300, 290,
I always
300.
Have to see. I know.
He's a big dude.
He does look big.
Yeah, nice guy too. Big guy. 200, what, 290, 291?
I'm looking. It's not easily. It's usually right. Available right there on Wiki, but on him, there's not much information.
Maybe it was waiting for Colleen. So anyways.
I need to edit this, yes.
Noah Fant. So Leo Williams was there last season. He just got a big contract now, extension. And
ooh,
Noah,
300 pounds, 6'5".
There you go.
Wow.
Noah Fant. He was the tight end that was on the team last year. He just got a deal with the Seahawks. And then they just brought in a new guy, Farrell Brown. He's another tight end. He was with the Cleveland Browns here for a second. I know he's with the New England Patriots. He's kind of had some different teams that he's been on, but he's going to be a Seahawk. So let me just tell you what's going on. The internet. By the way, I'm mad at the internet today. I'll get to that in a second. The internet is telling everyone how bad the Seahawks are doing in free agency. If you get on Twitter and you put Seahawks in the search bar, it will tell you you know, the internet will tell you how bad they're doing because they aren't making all of these moves. They aren't spending a whole bunch of money. How come you aren't doing with other, what others are doing? It's like being that kid at the birthday party. Everybody's opening up gifts and you just mad that you don't have a gift. But it ain't your damn birthday. But you mad you don't have a gift. You know what I mean? So I want to just tell everyone that the season doesn't start until September. The games don't get played until then. It is a lot of things that happen. Today is Wednesday. We're just into day three of the tampering period of the free agency. So it takes time. John Schneider is not going to just go out there and just give someone a whole bunch of money. I'll get specific. There's a player by the name of Patrick Queen. He was a linebacker for the Ravens. And so it was kind of assumed that, oh, Mike McDonald was the defensive coordinator for the Ravens last year. So, of course, Patrick Queen would come with him as a free agent and sign with the Seahawks. Well, he is not signing with the Seahawks. He's going to sign with the Steelers. And so people just kind of, not people, excuse me, the internet, you know, tells you that these things are going on. So I'm mad with the internet today because it's the same internet that told me that cat litter was in schools. It's the same internet. You know what I mean?
What are you talking about? Cat litters. Cat litter was in schools.
You never heard that story before?
No.
What? So the furries could use it?
Yeah. What I'm saying is that I'm mad at the internet because we, as long as it's a lot of people that say one thing, it seems to be like, oh, that's real. Like, for example, the internet tells you to go get those Stanley Cups.
Yeah, right.
Because you should go pay a lot of money for them.
I see the problem. Well, why don't we just amend the TikTok bill just to ban the internet?
Well, it all depends. Like, which way, because it's a flip-flop. Everybody decides. One minute they're against TikTok. One minute they're for TikTok. Which one is it today?
How about if you find yourself getting mad about strangers' opinions, you should just get off of all social media.
I don't. I'm not really mad. I'm just for the sake of the show. I'm just having fun here.
But, wait a second. You mean you gin up the outrage just for the show?
I know.
And then, right?
And then off the air, you're just a normal, ordinary human being? Wow.
No. No, not really.
Okay.
Off the
who wears pearls? A normal being who wears pearls.
I love G's pearls. You're always pointing out the pearls. He's got style.
Yeah. Would you ever wear pearls?
No.
Is there a reason you wouldn't wear pearls? Because I would wear pearls.
I just find myself clutching them all the time.
Oh. What?
Just because of the language the kids these days use.
Yeah, I know. He's...
So let me just, I just want to make sure, I want to leave everybody with this.
Yes.
It's okay. If you get on the internet and they tell you, oh, my goodness, the Seahawks aren't doing a good job, they're fine. There's a lot of movement that is happening. There's a lot of things that's going to happen between now and September. The games don't start until the second week in December. September. Not today. Not tomorrow. Not in April. Mm-hmm. In September.
Okay.
Well, I guess our sports talk station can just shut down then if everything's probably okay and no opinions need to be heard about sports. Is that what you're saying?
No, I'm saying no opinions needs to be that things are bad.
Don't worry about it.
I didn't say not
it.
Talk about sports.
Just keep calm and buy your
Colleen's got radio going today.
Yes, she is.
Yeah. All right.
G. Scott with Ursula at 9 o'clock on Cairo News Radio. And that is Mickey time. Mickey Gomez is here. Yesterday you were telling us to forget those expensive popular destinations and go to substitutes that sort of look like the place you really want to go to.
Destination dupes.
Right. But today you have tips on how to get cheap flights to your duplicate destination.
That's right. Seattle Times has a story about how you can find cheap flights this summer. And I remember doing a very similar story last month. But what I found is that there are even new tips out there to help you find the cheaper flights to go to those destinations that you're hoping to travel to this summer. Like the airlines, they're making money, okay? Time says the industry is going to bring in about $960 billion this year. That's up 7.5% from last year. So we're traveling, okay? But when we go online and we try and book flight, it's like a game almost. Because we're like, I like that price, but I'm not sure I want to pay that price. Mm-hmm. And so what ends up happening is that we either go to a third-party website, and we're like, oh, that's a little higher than the other price. Then we go back to the original website that we were at, and we want to book that flight. And then we go, oh, what happened? That price just went up.
Yeah.
It's crazy. So I've got some tips to help you find that cheaper flight.
So chips is what you want to call it.
Yeah, I want to call it cheap tips.
Tips.
Right. Cheap chips. Tips. There we go.
Yeah.
If it's a short flight, fly economy. Nothing wrong with economy. Just being a little bit uncomfortable for about an hour and a half. And I do this all the time because I fly with my kids. We travel a lot. Gigi has tournaments. You know, we like to go visit family in Michigan and Texas. We'll fly economy.
That's a long flight, Michigan and Texas.
Those are long flights. We pay a little bit more for that. But if I'm going to Salt Lake City, I'll do an economy flight.
Sure.
If I'm going to San Francisco, I'll do an economy flight.
So an hour and a half is about your threshold?
Hour and a half. Okay. If it's 2 hours, I'm going to pay a little bit more. Keep a watch on your travel destination. You can actually sign up for those notifications to find out if there is an actual price drop on tickets.
Those are great. Sometimes my husband will come to me and he'll be like, hey, you want to go to, you know, such and such? Flights are $200. And it's like, yeah, sure, why not?
Yeah, exactly. Check for flights incognito. I didn't know how to do that. I learned how to do it. You check for flights incognito, and then they can't target you. They can't do the Facebook retargeting,
what that
the
means,
Google.
Though.
So, okay. So, incognito, the web browser, the VPN can't get, they're not going to see it. So, the internet is not going to know that you're searching for flights. So, that way they can target you and say, aha, you wanted it for this. You didn't buy it. So, now we're going to increase the flights. Does
some
that make sense?
Some of them are called private mode. Some are called incognito. Some
That's true. Google flights. I learned about this from my best friend in Portugal. He says, you don't use Google flights. What's wrong with you? And I'm like, I don't even know what it is. It's a third-party website that'll track all the flights to your travel destination. It'll show you the cheapest airfare possible from all the airlines. And it'll even say, hey, you know what? You're kind of flying during a very hot season. So maybe go to this destination in the fall and not in the summer. Or maybe you want to go in the winter and not now. Be flexible. Wedding season's coming up. That means travel for some. The wedding's on Saturday. You want to fly on a Friday. It's going to be super expensive to get those tickets. Maybe leave on a Wednesday, Thursday. Another tip, clear your cookies. Mm. Want to clear the cookies, again, because in case you don't know how to go incognito or, you know, hidden. And buy your tickets on a Sunday.
I'm still so mad that they make flying so hard. I get so mad that we have to jump through all these hoops just to get somewhere.
We do. We do. It's like it's a game
and
when we go online.
People have the audacity to complain that nobody dresses up anymore when they get on airplanes. I'm not dressing up. I've already done all this work. I'm wearing my PJs. I'm being as comfy as possible because they make it as uncomfortable as possible from buying the tickets to getting home.
And then the luggage. You know, some airlines charge you to bring your carry-on on board. So, yeah, flying isn't the way it used to be, for sure. But there are ways to get around flying and paying an arm and a leg for airline tickets. So hopefully those tips will help.
I'm just looking on Google Flights. Mm-hmm. And for the flight that I make most often back to the East Coast, if you go on April 1st, $675.
Ooh.
If you go on April 30th, $286.
Unbelievable, right?
Same
so be
trip.
Flexible with your crazy. With your dates. What's happening April 1st?
April Fool's Day.
Nothing.
Spring break.
Oh, spring break.
It's spring break for
so that's why it's
for
so
our
high.
Part of the country. Right. That's why it's so high. But at the end of April, kids are back in school, new session, and we're moving into summer.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Thank you, Mickey.
You're very welcome.
You've just saved us a whole week's paycheck.
Hopefully. Yeah.
Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News, the podcast. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. You can find our podcast weekday mornings right at 9:30.
And if you subscribe, you will never miss the Daily Dose of Kindness.